Welcome to episode 89 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and this is the second of our podcast's first ever hat trick of episodes in 1 week. Today we're talking to R.J. Corretto about his debut mystery, Death on the Sapphire. Richard's novel, the first in a series, features an engaging protagonist, Lady Frances Foulkes, who takes it upon herself to investigate the suspicious death of a friend who is a veteran of the Boer War in South Africa. It's not all tea parties and feathered tiaras, though. Lady Frances's story includes discrimination, class hostility, upper to lower, and vice versa, and the recognition of what is now called PTSD. Here's Richard Corretto. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest today is R.J. Corretto, whose debut novel, Death on the Sapphire, is being published in mid-June. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you for having me here.
Death on the Sapphire is your debut mystery novel, but you have published mystery short stories, and I'm curious what drew you to the genre.
Yeah, I've always had an interest in both mysteries and in history. I started reading mystery stories when I was a boy. I started with Hardy Boys and, you know, graduated to Agatha Christie. At the same time, I've always had an academic interest in history. So as I got older, I started reading a lot of historical fiction, which I still do to this day. I studied a lot of history in college, and I've always had an enormous interest in that. So when I started writing, this is sort of a merging of my two interests, mystery stories, but doing some historical research, too, to make sure these characters were in touch with and worked with the history of the time period. So it's sort of my two favorite interests and hobbies merged together in historical mysteries.
Well, Death on the Sapphire does combine a unique character, Lady Frances Foulkes, and we'll get into her in a second. And it's also set in what can be viewed as an underutilized period of English history, the Edwardian era at the beginning of the 20th century. When you were conceiving this story, which will become a series, were these two elements always hand in hand?
Yes, I'd always been interested in this period. If you're of the right age, you remember back to the 1970s when the original Upstairs Downstairs series introduced to American audiences this period, which hadn't been much known at the tail end of the Victorian era, but right before World War I. And on one hand, some things were very old-fashioned, gender attitudes, class attitudes. The clothing was very 19th century. But at the same time, so many new things were happening, agitation for women's suffrage. There were new technology things coming out. I mean, on the cusp was the invention of the airplane, the development of modern ships. All these things were very brand new, and people didn't really see all that coming. They were sort of sitting there living in an old-fashioned world when a very modern world was coming. And it provided a lot of tension and a lot of interest as some people were looking backwards and forwards at the same time.
So let's talk about Lady Frances Foulkes. And I am pronouncing that correctly?
You got it exactly right.
Okay. Your main character. She has a title. She's an independent woman in a time when being an independent woman wasn't just frowned on, it could be scandalous.
Yes, I mean, women, and this is true, women in all classes were expected to get married and raise a family. And the occupations, as they were, for these women, for upper-class women, was to be a sort of helper to their husband. If they were involved in politics, they'd be a political hostess. But the idea of having something separate was very radical at this time. But women were beginning to enter certain professions. There were some changes. Certain parts of the British Empire, like in some of the colonies, like in Australia, New Zealand, were allowing women to vote in local elections. And some Western states in the United States were allowing women to vote in local and statewide elections, too. So that was very exciting, and it gave women a taste of political power that many of them were trying to bring to a national level in both Washington and in London. And so you had this wave of forward-looking women who were trying to carve out a new way. There were new schools around, both in the United States and in and in England that were giving women more and more education to provide them with the means to think more independently of their husbands and to encourage them to perhaps get jobs in the future. And so it was a very exciting, changing time.
And I have to ask this. It's not unheard of for a man to create a female protagonist, but it is still a little bit unusual. And I'm wondering if you had a specific inspiration for doing this.
That's very funny. That came up. I had written a bunch of novels that didn't go anywhere. My agent shopped them around, and they got some good feedback, but none of them were ever accepted. And these all had male protagonists. And one of the people we showed it to said, you know, this book isn't right for us. He said, but I want to ask you, this editor said. She said, I really like your female characters. He said, I find them, even though they weren't the protagonist, he said, I found them some of the most engaging parts of the book he showed me. And so I shrugged and I said, well, let me try. There's no law that says a man can't write about a woman protagonist. So that's how Lady Frances was born. That was my first attempt to write a book with a female protagonist, and I showed it to my agent, and she liked it. She thought it worked well. And, you know, it clicked because that was the, you know, after showing, you know, maybe three or four books that didn't go anywhere, that was the one that got accepted by a publisher. And I'm still to a large extent scratching my head over that because, as you said, it's not unheard of, but it is somewhat unusual. And the fact that this happened, I find interesting and enlightening.
Well, it definitely works. And, you know, it's just so interesting. I think that it's a cautionary and instructive rather than cautionary. It's an instructive tale to writers to pay attention even when you're being turned down.
Yes, exactly. You know, I listen very carefully to the rejections. Most publishers were kind enough not to just reject books out of hand, but to say why, what they liked about it or why it didn't work for them. There was another book that still I have in manuscript form. They looked at it and they said, we liked your writing and we liked the plot. They said, we didn't like your characters. We found them so unpleasant. Almost every single one of your characters we found unpleasant. It was just stunning because I kind of like my characters. And I'm thinking, Where did I go wrong here? I like these characters, and they just turned off the editor. So I kind of, it made me think more about characterization, about making them engaging, about, you know, obviously there are villains and people you don't like, but there should be a host of characters that the reader likes, if not identifies with, at least finds engaging, finds entertaining, finds wanting to revisit again and again. And, so that's what gave me an impetus. Sort of I looked at every rejection as sort of a little lesson to proceed to the next book.
England, we already discussed this briefly. England during the Edwardian era is often overlooked for many of the reasons that you mentioned. But some historians might say that the Boer War, which is the backdrop, the days after the Boer War, is the backdrop for Death on the Sapphire. It's not a spoiler to say that the Sapphire is a river in South Africa where there was a battle. But the Boer War was a precursor to a lot of what went wrong in Europe in the first half of the 20th century. And so is that part of what you're sort of the groundwork you're beginning to lay down, the foundation you're beginning to lay down for your series?
Yes. I'd like to put some real strong history into my novels. And what grabbed me about the Boer War is that it's little known in the United States. It was really a European and African affair. It didn't really involve the United States at all. So many Americans don't know about it. But in many ways, it not only foreshadowed World War I, it foreshadowed Vietnam. It was essentially England's taste of what these wars would be like, you know, coming out of in the post-war world, post-World War II, of really nationalism, citizen armies and things like that. And I'm thinking, this affected these people at this time. I mean, I know it's a novel, not a history book, but to try and get into the minds of these characters and think, they're facing this now, what we only face, you know, maybe later in modern times. And it shows a parallel between, you know, then and now, and things suddenly don't feel so different. If you say they face some of the same fears and anger and worries about what happened then as we do now. And that's what I find one of the most engaging things, to not only show what was different, but to show what was the same.
Right, and we should also mention that Winston Churchill got his political start in the Boer War, and that might have influenced him further down the line.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he lived so long, Churchill, that we tend to forget how old he was when he died. That he very much came out of the Victorian era background and Victorian Edwardian, and that's where he got his political start. And it seems like the Boer War shaped his thoughts and his policies on colonialism, the fighting of the war, and how he adapted, or sometimes had difficulty adapting, in the late 40s after World War II, because so much of his generation was shaped by this time. And that is absolutely fascinating. We only think of him really as an old man, but this is what shaped him as a young man.
And of course, you also mentioned earlier that although the mores and the conventions among society, and I mean that with a small s as well as a big s, were very Victorian, this was the time of the technological revolution. There was, electricity was becoming more widespread. People were getting telephones. Communication was just exploding, and it changed people in ways they weren't even aware of, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's some wonderful things. I mean, going into the Victorian era, the two largest sectors of employment were farming was number one and domestic service was number two. You either worked somebody else's farm or you worked in somebody else's manor house, and that was the big employers. But things were changing. Electricity meant people had more hours. The funny thing was many clergymen spoke out against the electrification because they felt that by being able to be lit at night would encourage vices. It might encourage brothels and things like that, because it made it easier for people to get up to no good at nighttime. I mean, it actually had an emotional impact, but they actually spoke out against it. The growth of factories meant that the working class had more choices. Some of them found, domestic service a little restrictive, particularly men who had more choices. So they'd be more likely to maybe look for factory work, which, enabled them to get married. Servants were generally discouraged from getting married. So they'd be going into factories, and that was a big thing. The train travel, which was so huge, meant even people of modest means could easily get around the country. So it meant relocating, traveling somewhere new for work, suddenly became easier too. We don't think about it either, but the growth of automobiles and trains meant people needed fewer horses. And fewer horses meant less grain needed to be grown to feed those horses. That meant land became less valuable. So other investments in factories became more important as farms became economically less important. So you had all these changes. And for everybody, it meant that the aristocrats who were relying on their farms suddenly had less income. Factory owners were owned by middle-class people, factories owned by middle-class. They just grew and grew and grew, and you had these changes, and people weren't even realizing it at the time. But you had all these changes and the tension. I mean, in my second book, Lady Frances gets to ride in a new car by a new company named Rolls Royce, which issued its first car in 1907. And nobody saw what that would change. It became an industrial giant in England. But in 1907, they just made one luxury car, and that changed everything.
Well, let's talk a tiny bit about the story. On the back cover, the book is described as woody and winsome. But to me, I saw a lot of dark undercurrents. Lady Frances is asked to help investigate the death of a close friend who had been an officer in the Boer War and who had suffered from what we would now call PTSD.
Yes.
And there's suggestion, not officially, but there's suggestion that he committed suicide, which of course was a terrible thing. For public consumption, you know, it was always an accident cleaning his gun. But suspicions are raised, and along the way, as she's investigating, she runs into these, you know, discrimination against women, specifically her, class hostility from both sides, you know, from top to bottom and from bottom to top. And I wanted you to talk about how you treated these things in the course of the story.
The class problem has always been of interest to me. And I started reading, you know, Jane Austen, which is, of course, like a century earlier. But, you know, Britain was such a class-conscious, and in many ways still is, a very class-conscious society, though it's a lot more fluid than it was 100 years ago. And to look at it both ways, to look at it up, down, and down, up, is that there was very little movement. And this was just the beginning of the time when some people found that they could, you know, maybe move up if they were lucky and hardworking and just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But most people were stuck where they were, and there were some resentments. And I find that exciting. I find that particularly interesting in the character I have of Frances, if her lady's maid, June Mallow. And in one way, they are very close. You know, it's almost an intimate relationship. I mean, this is a maid who helps her get ready for bed, who helps, you know, draw a bath for her. And on the other hand, though, the class differences are so wide, there are some things they can only hint at. There are some things they can't really discuss with each other because not only are they employer-employee, they are working class and aristocrat. And, you know, like when Lady Frances has a romance, that's not something she can directly, too intimate to discuss with her maid, even though her maid knows so much about her. And that's something that we don't even have a way of looking at here in the United States today. There are class differences, but things are so much more fluid, and you don't have those rigid barriers that people can't move from one to the other. I find that interesting, and I find the exploration of that and all the problems that can lead to, you know, a continual source of inspiration and interest.
And, of course, Lady Frances has always been underestimated because she's a woman. If she isn't directly being condescended to or just being ignored, she's encounters enormous resistance because of her sex.
Yes, it was a complicated thing. On one hand, you know, many men did appreciate, you know, the value of an intelligent wife there. I mean, the idea of being a good political hostess could be invaluable to a, you know, an upper class man who was having a political career. And in the lower classes too, you know, women, you know, helped run businesses and things like that, even if they weren't acknowledged as doing so. But so many things were limited to them. I mean, they couldn't enter politics directly. They could only do these things through the side. So the idea of, you know, Lady Frances trying to do or coming in things from the side, so to speak, you know, using influential names that she has, scraping acquaintances with her brother's friends and associates, because her brother is a, you know, he's a lord, he's a member of the House of Lords, he's got an important position in government. You know, people who want to curry favor with her powerful and wealthy family. So, I mean, I think that's what women did to a large extent. They, the women who wanted power, who wanted influence, used what was available to them, the acquaintances they had, their power as political hostesses. You find that in novels that were written in the 19th century. I mean, this isn't something that I discovered alone, but you see that throughout the works of Anthony Trollope, for example, who shows a lot of very strong women who use these sort of, you know, sideways, these women entering into politics sideways to do that. And I find that very interesting, too, because we look upon women as being very powerless before they had the vote, before they had economic power and entrance into the professions. And yet, although that was all true, the fact was that clever and smart women managed to find power anyway. And I think Lady Frances is just an extreme example of that.
And of course, in Lady Frances' case, and very specifically, she has control over her own money because she's single. And that puts her in a unique position, and also one that might want to make her a little reluctant to get married, because, of course, in those days, if you had independent means, if you're a woman of independent means, when you got married, your means were no longer independent.
Right. They were just beginning to pass some laws that were making it a little easier for married women economically, but it was still very much in favor of the men. Divorce is almost unheard of. And when it happened, the women could be left completely destitute, even if she brought money into the marriage. So many independent women were nervous about that, getting married. And I'm not giving too much away to say that Lady Frances has some suitors of different classes, and she has to wonder about that. And on the other hand, and this is also something that was common too, her, although she had an independent income, her money was tied up. It was essentially she was living off what might be her dowry that her father left her, the idea being that she should not have full control of her money until she was married and had a husband who would take charge of it. Until then, she can only live off the income from that. And the idea of a woman managing her own money without a trustee, if not her father, then an older brother or a trusted lawyer to oversee this, was a very common idea. Women went from their father's protection, or in some cases the father was deceased, an older brother's protection or an uncle's protection, until their husband's protection. And that's something that Lady Frances is very leery of. I mean, she realizes that both political and economic power have to go together.
In a earlier communication you and I had, you mentioned that S.J. Rosen is a favorite author of yours, and I was wondering who else in the genre you enjoy reading, and who else has influenced you, although you've already mentioned Agatha Christie and Jane Austen. And
sure. I pick different writers for what they do best. What Agatha Christie does best is plotting. And it's something that never really occurred to me until I tried to write a book myself. And I'm thinking of all the things of writing a novel, the hardest thing is making a coherent plot, you know, run over some 80,000 to 90,000 words. And that is still the most difficult thing. And it makes me appreciate Christie all the more, that when she was at her best, like in Death on the Nile or Orient Express, the plot moves so beautifully forward and yet so rationally, and you really appreciate that skill. I also love, although I've only read them in translation, Simenon's Inspecting My Gray books. And he can set a setting like nobody else can. He just, beautiful setting. And I wish I could do that too. And, you know, he just creates a scene that's so obvious in your mind. One of my other favorites is Stephen Saylor. And he writes a wonderful series called The Roma Sub Roma, that takes place at sort of the height of the Roman Republic, right around the time of Caesar. And he does a wonderful job of integrating his fictional detective with real people like Caesar and Crassus and Pompey, and great writers of that period as well. And it becomes very smooth. And I'm thinking, that's so wonderful, the way he creates a fictional story that involves real historical people. And I like to bring in real historical people into my books from time to time. And so that's been a real pattern for me for history. And I like those. And I also like Victoria Thompson. She has her Gaslight Mysteries, which is a turn of the century New York City. And I'm a native New Yorker. My family's always lived in New York. My grandfather was born in New York City in 1896. So this is very much the period. And I remember him telling me stories of his childhood. So to read a mystery that's a period that I know from my grandfather's stories is also very exciting. So, you know, I try and get those things, the settings, from people I admire, from writers I admire, and see how they do it, and see, you know, take lessons from their plotting and their creation of characters, and you know, and add my own particular perspective in it.
Death on the Sapphire is the first in the series, and next up is Death Among Rubies. Can you tell us a bit about the next book?
Yes, it's both old-fashioned and modern. We take Lady Frances and her maid Mallow out of London, and almost all the action takes place at a great manor house, sort of a Downton Abbey type of manor house. So it's old-fashioned in that sense, but we also have a couple of characters, friends of Lady Frances, who are in what we would call today a same-sex relationship, and so explore some of the attitudes that they would have at this time to same-sex romantic relationships, and how that was either acknowledged or had to be hidden at that time, and how society understood but didn't talk about things like that. And I'm also keeping in mind some modern touches, too. It takes place among a conference of diplomats, and this is a time when countries were jockeying for position in the decade before World War II. I'm sorry, a decade before World War I. And, you know, so you had a lot of foreigners there. There's a Turkish visitor, right? A representative from what was in the Ottoman Empire. And he, of course, is Muslim. So, so he's very exotic to to many of the Englishmen who had never met a Muslim before, and are trying to adjust his different attitudes, and he's trying to understand the English. So you have those very modern touches there in what is, you know, a traditional sort of country house setting. And I was very pleased with the way it came out. You know, so you have Lady Frances trying to navigate these very touchy issues and to solve the brutal murder of a diplomat at this country house. And, so some of the same characters come in again. Once again, Scotland Yard is involved, and she's trying to work with them, and they're trying to avoid her. And her brother's involved, too, because he's a high-ranking diplomat. And I was very excited with the way that came out. And, I hope already mapping out the third one and, continue Lady Frances' adventures.
Well, you anticipate my following question, which is, do you have a specific number of books in mind for Lady Frances? And assuming that you're staying with the naming convention of the first two titles, will there be as many books as there are precious gems?
See how people like it. I'm actually working on simultaneously working on another series. I just finished a book, and it'll probably come out next year. It takes place at the same time period, but in New York, and it features Alice Roosevelt, and she was President Teddy Roosevelt's oldest daughter, and she was a very notable personality, a very strong, scandalous. She led a scandalous life and was a much admired and sought after Washington hostess. I mean, she lived to be well into her 90s. And met every single president from McKinley to Gerald Ford. So she was enormous. I'm imagining her as a young woman solving mysteries in New York. And so it's going to be a very strong New York theme, and taking this very strong personality and imagining her as an amateur detective in New York City, working among both the upper classes, you know, the Roosevelts and the other great families of New York, as well as the immigrant population of New York, too. So I'm very excited about that. It's similar time period to Lady Frances, but a somewhat different milieu. And we'll see how both those series go over time.
And, of course, Alice Roosevelt's father was the police commissioner of New York City, we should add.
Exactly. And she'll be using her father's connections within the New York City Police Department to help with her private detection work, because he was much admired and respected by the police officers, and created huge reforms in the police department that carried on for many years and helped create a modern police department in New York. So she'll be calling on that, and she'll be getting her father's advice. He's going to be a regular appearances in these books. So I'm very excited about that.
That definitely gives us something to look forward to, and nothing like having two series. But I always ask this of every writer who has more than one series. Will your universes collide? Will you have Lady Frances, who, after all, went to university in the United States, coming to the United States, or vice versa?
I think I would love to do that. You've given that thought. It's the same time period. These two women are roughly the same age. Alice Roosevelt's a little bit younger. But I think they could find each other fascinating. you two very strong women. And I don't know if I mentioned, but Lady Frances was educated in New York. It was very hard for women to get a college education in England at that time. But Vassar College in the United States is providing a very high-quality post-secondary education for women. So Lady Frances knows New York because she was educated at Vassar College. So she might have very well known the Roosevelts. I mean, you know, the Roosevelts, they were very active in New York affairs. And Franklin Roosevelt was on the Vassar College Board of Trustees for several years. So I could have that. It would be very easy to mix them up, and I think that would be a fun thing to do at some future point. Have them work together.
Well, you heard it here first on Speaking of Mysteries. Thanks again, Richard, for joining us and for talking about your debut novel, Death on the Sapphire, as well as all of the other books that you're working on. Do you have a title for your New York book that's coming out?
It's yes, it is tentatively titled Alice and the Assassin. And Alice is going to investigate some of the fallout after McKinley's assassination. He was assassinated in 1901, and that's what brought her father to the White House. But there were and are to this day many unanswered questions about McKinley's assassination. Some of the motives was hard to come by. So I'm having her look into that past and see what really happened with McKinley's assassination. So it's got a little bit of a political thriller in there as well.
So political thriller, historical mystery. It's an all-in-one. we're looking forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.